For errors are just special cases of the variety of marks that speak loudly and intuitively of a shared history. The role of chance in twisting the paths taken in a bit of design work can create the same effect without creating an error. A case in point. In 1988, Otto Neugebauer, the great historian of astronomy, was sent a photograph of a fragment of Greek papyrus with a few numbers in a column on it. The sender, a classicist, had no clue about the meaning of this bit of papyrus and wondered if Neugebauer had any ideas. The 89-year-old scholar recomputed the line-to-line differences between the numbers, found their maximum and minimum limits, and determined that this papyrus had to be a translation of part of column G of a Babylonian cuneiform tablet on which was written a Babylonian System B lunar ephemeris. An ephemeris is, like the nautical almanac, a tabular system for computing the location of a heavenly body for every time in a particular period. How could Neugebauer make this Sherlock Holmesian deduction? Elementary. What was written in Greek, a sequence of sexagesimal, not decimal numbers, was recognized by him to be part, column G, of a highly accurate calculation of the moon's location that had been worked out by the Babylonians. There are lots of different ways of calculating an ephemeris, and Neugebauer knew that anyone working out their own ephemeris independently, using their own system, would not have come up with exactly the same numbers as anyone else, though the numbers might have been close. The Babylonian System B was excellent, so the design had been gratefully conserved in translation with all its fine-grained particularities. Neugebauer, 1989. Neugebauer was a great scholar, but you can probably execute a parallel feat of deduction following in his footsteps. Suppose you were sent a photocopy of the following text and asked the same questions. What does it mean? Where might this be from? Freunde Römer Mitbürger, get mir geboren. Ich komme, Caesarlich übergraben, nicht insuloben. You can probably figure it out even if you don't really know how to read the old German Fraktur typeface. And even if you don't know German. Do you get it? Impressive stunt. Neugebauer may have his Babylonian column G, but you quickly determined, didn't you, that this fragment must be part of a German translation of some lines from an Elizabethan tragedy. Julius Caesar, Act 3, Scene 2, lines 79 to 80 to be exact, friends, Romans, countrymen, etc. Once you think about it, you realize that it could hardly be anything else. The odds against this particular sequence of German letters getting strung together under any other circumstances are vast. Why? What is the particularity that marks such a string of symbols? Nicholas Humphrey, 1987, makes the question vivid by posing a more drastic version. If you were forced to consign to oblivion one of the following masterpieces, which would you choose? Newton's Principia? Chaucer's Canterbury Tales? Mozart's Don Giovanni? Or Eiffel's Tower? If the choice were forced, Humphrey answers, I'd have little doubt which it should be. The Principia would have to go. How so? Because of all those works, Newton's was the only one that was replaceable. Quite simply, if Newton had not written it, then someone else would, probably within the space of a few years. The Principia was a glorious monument to human intellect. The Eiffel Tower was a relatively minor feat of romantic engineering. Yet the fact is that while Eiffel did it his way, Newton merely did it God's way. Newton and Leibniz famously quarreled over who got to the calculus first, and one can readily imagine Newton having another quarrel with a contemporary over who should get priority on discovering the laws of gravitation. But had Shakespeare never lived, for example, no one else would have ever written his plays and poems. C.P. Snow, in The Two Cultures, extolled the great discoveries of science as scientific Shakespeare. But in one way, he was fundamentally mistaken. Shakespeare's plays were Shakespeare's plays, and no one else's. Scientific discoveries, by contrast, belong, ultimately, to no one in particular. Humphrey, 1987. Intuitively, the difference is the difference between discovery and creation. But we now have a better way of seeing it. On the one hand, there is design work that homes in on a best move or forced move, which can be seen, in retrospect at least, to be a uniquely favored location in design space, accessible from many starting points by many different paths. On the other hand, there is design work, the excellence of which is much more dependent on exploiting and amplifying the many contingencies of history that shape its trajectory. A trajectory about which the bus company's slogan is an understatement. Getting there is much more than half the fun. We heard in Chapter 2 that even the long division algorithm can avail itself of randomness or arbitrary idiosyncrasy. Choose a digit at random, or your favorite digit, and check to see if it's the right one. But the actual idiosyncratic choices made as you go along cancel out, leaving no trace in the final answer, the right answer. Other algorithms can incorporate the random choices into the structure of their final products. Think of a poetry writing algorithm, or a doggerel writing algorithm, if you insist, that begins, "Choose a noun at random from the dictionary." Such a design process can produce something that is definitely under quality control, selection pressure, but which nevertheless bears the unmistakable signs of its particular history of creation. Humphrey's contrast is sharp, but his vivid way of drawing it might mislead. Science, unlike the arts, is engaged in journeys, sometimes races, with definite destinations, solutions to specific problems in design space. But scientists do care just as much as artists do about the routes taken, and hence would be appalled at the idea of discarding Newton's actual work and just saving his destination, which someone else would eventually have led us to in any case. They care about the actual trajectories because the methods used in them can often be used again for other journeys. The good methods are cranes which can be borrowed, with acknowledgement, and used to do lifting in other parts of design space. In the extreme case, the crane developed by a scientist may be of much more value than the particular lifting accomplished by it, the destination reached. For instance, a proof of a trivial result may nevertheless pioneer a new mathematical method of great value. Mathematicians put a high value on coming up with a simpler, more elegant proof of something they have already proved, a more efficient crane. In this context, philosophy can be seen to lie about midway between science and the arts. Ludwig Wittgenstein famously stressed that in philosophy, the process, the arguing and analyzing, is more important than the product, the conclusions reached, the theories defended. Though this is hotly and correctly, in my opinion, disputed by many philosophers who aspire to solve real problems and not just indulge in a sort of interminable logotherapy, even they would admit that we would never want to consign Descartes' famous cogito ergo sum thought experiment, for example, to oblivion, even though none would accept its conclusions. It is just too nifty an intuition pump, even if all it pumps is falsehoods. Dennett, 1984, page 18. Why can't you copyright a successful multiplication of two numbers? Because anyone could do it. It's a forced move. The same is true of any simple fact that a genius isn't needed to discover. So how do the creators of tables or other routine but labor-intensive masses of printed data protect themselves from unscrupulous copiers? Sometimes they set traps. I am told, for instance, that the publishers of Who's Who have dealt with the problem of competitors simply stealing all their hard-won facts and publishing their own biographical encyclopedias by quietly inserting a few entirely bogus entries. You can be sure that if one of those shows up on a competitor's pages, it was no coincidence. In the larger perspective of the whole design space, the crime of plagiarism might be defined as theft of crane. Somebody or something has done some design work, thereby creating something that is useful in further design work and therefore may have value to anyone or anything embarked on a design project. In our world of culture, where the transmission of designs from agent to agent is enabled by many media of communication, the acquisition of designs developed in other shops is a common event, almost the defining mark of cultural evolution, which will be the topic of Chapter 12. It has commonly been assumed by biologists that such transactions were impossible in the world of genetics until the dawn of genetic engineering. You might say, in fact, that this has been the official dogma. Recent discoveries suggest otherwise, though only time will tell. No dogma ever rolled over and died without a fight. For instance, Marilyn Houck, Houck et al., 1991, has found evidence that about 40 years ago in either Florida or Central America, a tiny mite that feeds on fruit flies happened to puncture the egg of a fly of the Drosophila willistoni species, and in the process picked up some of that species' characteristic DNA, which it then inadvertently transmitted to the egg of a wild Drosophila melanogaster fly. This could explain the sudden explosion in the wild of a particular DNA element common in D. willistoni, but previously unheard of in D. melanogaster populations. She might add, what else could explain it? It sure looks like species plagiarism. Other researchers are looking at other possible vehicles for speedy design travel in the world of natural, as opposed to artificial, genetics. If they find them, they will be fascinating, but no doubt rare exceptions to the orthodox pattern. Genetic transmission of design by chains of direct descent only. We are inclined, as just noted, to contrast this feature sharply with what we find in the freewheeling world of cultural evolution, but even there we can detect a powerful dependence on the combination of luck and copying. Consider all the wonderful books in the Library of Babel that will never be written, even though the process that could create each of them involves no violation or abridgment of the laws of nature. Consider some book in the Library of Babel that you yourself might love to write, and that only you could write. For instance, the poetically expressed autobiographical tale of your childhood that would bring tears and laughter to all readers. We know that there are vast numbers of books with just these features in the Library of Babel, and each is composable in only a million keystrokes. At the dawdling rate of 500 strokes a day, the whole project shouldn't take you much longer than 6 years with generous vacations. Well, what's stopping you? You have fingers that work, and all the keys on your word processor can be depressed independently. Nothing is stopping you. That is, there needn't be any identifiable forces or laws of physics or biology or psychology or salient disabilities brought on by identifiable circumstances, such as an axe embedded in your brain or a gun pointed at you by a credible threatener. There are vastly many books that you are never going to write for no reason at all. Thanks to the myriad particular twists and turns of your life to date, you just don't happen to be well disposed to compose those sequences of keystrokes. If we want to get some perspective, limited to be sure, on what patterns go into creating your own authorial dispositions, we will have to consider the transmission of design to you from the books you have read. The books that actually come to exist in the world's libraries are deeply dependent not just on their author's biological inheritance, but on the books that have come before them. This dependence is conditioned by coincidences or accidents at every turning. Just look at my bibliography to discover the main lines of genealogy of this book. I have been reading and writing about evolution since I was an undergraduate. But if I had not been encouraged by Doug Hofstadter in 1980 to read Dawkins' The Selfish Gene, I probably would not have begun coalescing some of the interests and reading habits that have been major shapers of this audiobook. And if Hofstadter had not been asked by the New York Review of Books to review my book Brainstorms, 1978, he probably would never have hit upon the bright idea of proposing that we collaborate on a book, The Mind's Eye, 1981. And then we would not have had the opportunity for a mutual book recommending that led me to Dawkins, and so forth. Even if I had read the same books and articles by following other paths in a different order, I would not be conditioned in exactly the same way by that reading, and hence would have been unlikely to have composed and edited and re-edited just the string of symbols you are now listening to. Can we measure this transmission of design and culture? Are there units of cultural transmission analogous to the genes of biological evolution? Dawkins, 1976, has proposed that there are and has given them a name: memes. Like genes, memes are supposed to be replicators in a different medium, but subject to much the same principles of evolution as genes. The idea that there might be a scientific theory, memetics, strongly parallel to genetics, strikes many thinkers as absurd. But at least a large part of their skepticism is based on misunderstanding. This is a controversial idea, which will get careful consideration in Chapter 12, but in the meantime, we can set aside the controversies and just use the term as a handy word for a salient, memorable cultural item. Something with enough design to be worth saving, or stealing, or replicating. The Library of Mendel, or its twin, the Library of Babel, they are contained in each other, after all, is as good an approximate model of universal design space as we could ever need to think about. For the last 4 billion years or so, the tree of life has been zigzagging through this vast multidimensional space, branching and blooming with virtually unimaginable fecundity, but nevertheless managing to fill only a vanishingly small portion of that space of the possible with actual designs. According to Darwin's dangerous idea, all possible explorations of design space are connected. Not only all your children and your children's children, but all your brain children and your brain children's brain children must grow from the common stock of design elements, genes, and memes that have so far been accumulated and conserved by the inexorable lifting algorithms, the ramps and cranes atop cranes of natural selection and its products. If this is right, then all the achievements of human culture, language, art, religion, ethics, science itself, are themselves artifacts of artifacts of artifacts of the same fundamental process that developed the bacteria, the mammals, and Homo sapiens. There is no special creation of language, and neither art nor religion has a literally divine inspiration. If there are no skyhooks needed to make a skylark, there are also no skyhooks needed to make an ode to a nightingale. No meme is an island. Life and all its glories are thus united under a single perspective. But some people find this vision hateful, barren, odious. They want to cry out against it, and above all, they want to be magnificent exceptions to it. They, if not the rest, are made in God's image by God, or if they are not religious, they want to be skyhooks themselves. They want somehow to be intrinsic sources of intelligence or design, not mere artifacts of the same processes that mindlessly produce the rest of the biosphere. So a lot is at stake. Before we turn in part 3 to examine in detail the implications of the upward spread of universal acid through human culture, we need to secure the base camp by considering a variety of deep challenges to Darwinian thinking within biology itself. In the process, our vision of the intricacy and power of the underlying ideas will be enhanced. Chapter 6. There is one design space, and in it the tree of life has grown a branch that has recently begun casting its own exploratory threads into that space, in the form of human artifacts. Forced moves and other good ideas are like beacons in design space, discovered again and again by the ultimately algorithmic search processes of natural selection and human investigation. As Darwin appreciated, we can retrospectively detect the historical fact of descent anywhere in design space when we find shared design features that would be vastly unlikely to coexist unless there was a thread of descent between them. Historical reasoning about evolution thus depends on accepting Paley's premise: the world is full of good design, which took work to create. This completes the introduction to Darwin's dangerous idea. Now we must secure its base camp in biology in part 2 before looking at its power to transform our understanding of the human world in part 3. Chapter 7, How Did the Tree of Life Get Started? Skeptics have thought a stroke of special creation, a skyhook, must be needed to get the evolutionary process going. There is a Darwinian answer to this challenge, however, which exhibits the power of Darwin's universal acid to work its way down through the lowest levels of the cosmic pyramid, showing how even the laws of physics might emerge from chaos or nothingness without recourse to a special creator or even a lawgiver. This dizzying prospect is one of the most feared aspects of Darwin's dangerous idea. But the fear is misguided. Part 2. Darwinian Thinking in Biology. Evolution is a change from a know-howish, untalkaboutable all-alikeness by continuous stick-togetherations and something-elsifications. William James, 1880. Nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution. Theodosius Dobzhansky, 1973. Chapter 7. Priming Darwin's Pump. 1. Back Beyond Darwin's Frontier. And God said, "Let the earth bring forth grass, the herb yielding seed, and the fruit tree yielding fruit after his kind, whose seed is in itself upon the earth." And it was so. And the earth brought forth grass, and herb yielding seed after his kind, and the tree yielding fruit, whose seed was in itself after his kind. And God saw that it was good. Genesis, chapter 1, verses 11 through 12. From what sort of seed could the tree of life get started? That all life on earth has been produced by such a branching process of generation is now established beyond any reasonable doubt. It is as secure an example of a scientific fact as the roundness of the earth, thanks in large part to Darwin. But how did the whole process get started in the first place? As we discussed in Chapter 3, Darwin not only started in the middle, he cautiously refrained from pushing his own published thinking back to the beginning, the ultimate origin of life and its preconditions. When pressed by correspondence, he had little more to say in private. In a famous letter, he surmised that it was quite possible that life began in a warm little pond, but he had no details to offer about the likely recipe for this primeval pre-organic soup. And in response to Asa Gray, as we discussed, he left wide open the possibility that the laws that would govern this earth-shattering move were themselves designed, presumably by God. His reticence on this score was wise on several counts. First, no one knew better than he the importance of anchoring a revolutionary theory in the bedrock of empirical facts. And he knew that he could only speculate, with scant hope in his own day of getting any substantive feedback. After all, as we have already talked about, he didn't even have the Mendelian concept of the gene, let alone any of the molecular machinery underlying it. Darwin was an intrepid deducer, but he also knew when he didn't have enough premises to go on. Besides, there was his concern for his beloved wife Emma, who desperately wanted to cling to her religious beliefs, and who could already see the threat looming in her husband's work. Yet his reluctance to push any farther into this dangerous territory, at least in public, went beyond his consideration for her feelings. There is a wider ethical consideration at stake, which Darwin certainly appreciated. Much has been written about the moral dilemmas that scientists face when the discovery of a potentially dangerous fact puts their love of truth at odds with their concern for the welfare of others. Under what conditions, if any, would they be obliged to conceal the truth? These can be real dilemmas, with powerful and hard-to-plumb considerations on both sides. But there is no controversy at all about what a scientist's or philosopher's moral obligations should be regarding his or her speculations. Science doesn't often advance by the methodical piling up of demonstrable facts. The cutting edge is almost always composed of several rival edges, sharply competing and boldly speculative. Many of these speculations soon prove to be misbegotten, however compelling at the outset, and these necessary byproducts of scientific investigation should be considered to be as potentially hazardous as any other laboratory wastes. One must consider their environmental impact. If their misapprehension by the public would be apt to cause suffering, by misleading people into dangerous courses of action or by undercutting their allegiance to some socially desirable principle or creed, scientists should be particularly cautious about how they proceed, scrupulous about labeling speculations as such, and keeping the rhetoric of persuasion confined to its proper targets. But ideas, unlike toxic fumes or chemical residues, are almost impossible to quarantine, particularly when they concern themes of abiding human curiosity. So, whereas there is no controversy at all about the principle of responsibility here, there has been scant agreement then or now about how to honor it. Darwin did the best he could. He kept his speculations pretty much to himself. We can do better. The physics and chemistry of life are now understood in dazzling detail, so that much more can be deduced about the necessary and perhaps sufficient conditions for life. The answers to the big questions must still involve a large measure of speculation, but we can mark the speculations as such and note how they could be confirmed or disconfirmed. There would be no point anymore in trying to pursue Darwin's policy of reticence. Too many very interesting cats are already out of the bag. We may not yet know exactly how to take all these ideas seriously, but thanks to Darwin's secure beachhead in biology, we know that we can and must. It is small wonder that Darwin didn't hit upon a suitable mechanism of heredity. What do you suppose his attitude would have been to the speculation that within the nucleus of each of the cells in his body, there was a copy of a set of instructions, written on huge macromolecules in the form of double helixes tightly kinked into snarls to form a set of 46 chromosomes. The DNA in your body, unsnarled and linked, would stretch to the sun and back several, 10 or 100 times. Of course, Darwin is the man who painstakingly uncovered a host of jaw-dropping complexities in the lives and bodies of barnacles, orchids, and earthworms, and described them with obvious relish. Had he had a prophetic dream back in 1859 about the wonders of DNA, he would no doubt have reveled in it. But I wonder if he could have recounted it with a straight face. Even to those of us accustomed to the engineering miracles of the computer age, the facts are hard to encompass. Not only molecule-sized copying machines, but proofreading enzymes that correct mistakes, all at blinding speed, on a scale that supercomputers still cannot match. Biological macromolecules have a storage capacity that exceeds that of the best present-day information stores by several orders of magnitude. For example, the information density in the genome of E. coli is about 10 to the 27th power bits per meter cubed. Cooper's, 1990, page 180. In Chapter 5, we arrived at a Darwinian definition of biological possibility in terms of accessibility within the Library of Mendel. But the precondition for that library, as we noted, was the existence of genetic mechanisms of staggering complexity and efficiency. William Paley would have been transported with admiration and wonder at the atomic-level intricacies that make life possible at all. How could they themselves have evolved if they are the precondition for Darwinian evolution? Skeptics about evolution have argued that this is the fatal flaw in Darwinism. As we have discussed, the power of the Darwinian idea comes from the way it distributes the huge task of design through vast amounts of time and space, preserving the partial products as it proceeds. In Evolution, A Theory in Crisis, Michael Denton puts it this way. The Darwinian assumes that islands of function are common, easily found in the first place, and that it is easy to go from island to island through functional intermediates. Denton, 1985, page 317. This is almost right, but not quite. Indeed, the central claim of Darwinism is that the tree of life spreads out its branches, connecting islands of function with isthmuses of intermediate cases. But nobody said the passage would be easy or the safe stopping places common. There is only one strained sense of easy in which Darwinism is committed to these isthmus crossings being easy. Since every living thing is a descendant of a living thing, it has a tremendous leg up. All but the tiniest fraction of its recipe is guaranteed to have time-tested viability. The lines of genealogy are lifelines indeed. According to Darwinism, the only hope of entering this cosmic maze of junk and staying alive is to stay on the isthmuses. But how could this process get started? Denton, page 323, goes to some lengths to calculate the improbability of such a startup and arrives at a suitably mind-numbing number. To get a cell by chance would require at least 100 functional proteins to appear simultaneously in one place. That is 100 simultaneous events, each of an independent probability which would hardly be more than 10 to the negative 20th power, giving a maximum combined probability of 10 to the negative 2,000th power. This probability is vanishing indeed, next to impossible. And it looks at first as if the standard Darwinian response to such a challenge could not, as a matter of logic, avail us, since the very preconditions for its success, a system of replication with variation, are precisely what only its success would permit us to explain. Evolutionary theory appears to have dug itself into a deep pit, from which it cannot escape. Surely the only thing that could save it would be a skyhook. This was Asa Gray's fond hope, and the more we have learned about the intricacies of DNA replication, the more enticing this idea has become to those who are searching for a place to bail out science with some help from religion. One might say that it has appeared to many to be a godsend. Forget it, says Richard Dawkins. Maybe, it is argued, the Creator does not control the day-to-day succession of evolutionary events. Maybe he did not frame the tiger and the lamb. Maybe he did not make a tree. But he did set up the original machinery of replication and replicator power, the original machinery of DNA and protein that made cumulative selection and hence all of evolution, possible. This is a transparently feeble argument. Indeed, it is obviously self-defeating. Organized complexity is the thing we are having difficulty explaining. Once we are allowed simply to postulate organized complexity, if only the organized complexity of the DNA protein replicating engine, it is relatively easy to invoke it as a generator of yet more organized complexity. But of course, any god capable of intelligently designing something as complex as the DNA protein replicating machine must have been at least as complex and organized as the machine itself. Dawkins, 1986A, page 141. As Dawkins goes on to say on page 316, the one thing that makes evolution such a neat theory is that it explains how organized complexity can arise out of primeval simplicity. This is one of the key strengths of Darwin's idea, and the key weakness of the alternatives. In fact, I once argued it is unlikely that any other theory could have this strength. Darwin explains a world of final causes and teleological laws with a principle that is, to be sure, mechanistic, but, more fundamentally, utterly independent of meaning or purpose. It assumes a world that is absurd in the existentialist's sense of the term. Not ludicrous, but pointless. And this assumption is a necessary condition of any non-question-begging account of purpose. Whether we can imagine a non-mechanistic but also non-question-begging principle for explaining design in the biological world is doubtful. It is tempting to see the commitment to non-question-begging accounts here as tantamount to a commitment to mechanistic materialism. But the priority of these commitments is clear. One argues Darwin's materialistic theory may not be the only non-question-begging theory of these matters, but it is one such theory, and the only one we have found which is quite a good reason for espousing materialism. Dennett, 1975, pages 171 to 72. Is that a fair or even an appropriate criticism of the religious alternatives? One reader of an early draft of this chapter complained at this point, saying that by treating the hypothesis of God as just one more scientific hypothesis, to be evaluated by the standards of science in particular and rational thought in general, Dawkins and I are ignoring the very widespread claim by believers in God that their faith is quite beyond reason, not a matter to which such mundane methods of testing applies. It is not just unsympathetic, he claimed, but strictly unwarranted for me simply to assume that the scientific method continues to apply with full force in this domain of faith. Very well. Let's consider the objection. I doubt that the defender of religion will find it attractive once we explore it carefully. The philosopher Ronald de Souza once memorably described philosophical theology as intellectual tennis without a net. And I readily allow that I have indeed been assuming, without comment or question up to now, that the net of rational judgment was up. But we can lower it if you really want to. It's your serve. Whatever you serve, suppose I return service rudely as follows. What you say implies that God is a ham sandwich wrapped in tinfoil. That's not much of a God to worship. If you then volley back demanding to know how I can logically justify my claim that your serve has such a preposterous implication, I will reply, oh, do you want the net up for my returns, but not for your serves? Either the net stays up or it stays down. If the net is down, there are no rules, and anybody can say anything. A mug's game, if there ever was one. I have been giving you the benefit of the assumption that you would not waste your own time or mine by playing with the net down. Now, if you want to reason about faith and offer a reasoned and reason-responsive defense of faith as an extra category of belief worthy of special consideration, I'm eager to play. I certainly grant the existence of the phenomenon of faith. What I want to see is a reasoned ground for taking faith seriously as a way of getting to the truth, and not, say, just as a way people comfort themselves and each other. A worthy function that I do take seriously. But you must not expect me to go along with your defense of faith as a path to truth if at any point you appeal to the very dispensation you are supposedly trying to justify. Before you appeal to faith, when reason has you backed into a corner, think about whether you really want to abandon reason when reason is on your side. You are sightseeing with a loved one in a foreign land, and your loved one is brutally murdered in front of your eyes. At the trial, it turns out that in this land, friends of the accused may be called as witnesses for the defense, testifying about their faith in his innocence. You watch the parade of his moist-eyed friends, obviously sincere, proudly proclaiming their undying faith in the innocence of the man you saw commit the terrible deed. The judge listens intently and respectfully, obviously more moved by this outpouring than by all the evidence presented by the prosecution. Is this not a nightmare? Would you be willing to live in such a land? Or would you be willing to be operated on by a surgeon who tells you that whenever a little voice in him tells him to disregard his medical training, he listens to the little voice? I know it passes in polite company to let people have it both ways, and under most circumstances I wholeheartedly cooperate with this benign arrangement. But we're seriously trying to get at the truth here. And if you think that this common but unspoken understanding about faith is anything better than socially useful obfuscation to avoid mutual embarrassment and loss of face, you have either seen much more deeply into this issue than any philosopher ever has, for none has ever come up with a good defense of this, or you are kidding yourself. The ball is now in your court. Dawkins' retort to the theorist who would call on God to jumpstart the evolution process is an unrebuttable refutation. As devastating today as when Philo used it to trounce Cleanthes in Hume's dialogues 2 centuries earlier, a skyhook would at best simply postpone the solution to the problem. But Hume couldn't think of any cranes, so he caved in. Darwin came up with some magnificent cranes to do middle-level lifting, but can the principles that worked so well once be applied again to do the lifting required to get the booms of Darwin's cranes off the ground in the first place? Yes. Just when it might appear that the Darwinian idea has come to the end of its resources, it jumps niftily down a level and keeps right on going. Not just one idea, but many, multiplying like the brooms of the sorcerer's apprentice. If you want to understand this trick, which at first glance seems unimaginable, you have to wrestle with some difficult ideas and a raft of details, both mathematical and molecular. This is not the book, and I am not the author you should consult for those details, and nothing less could really secure your understanding. So what follows comes with a warning. Although I will try to acquaint you with these ideas, you won't really know them unless you study them in the primary literature. My own grasp on them is that of an amateur. Imaginative, theoretical, and experimental explorations of the possibilities are now being conducted by so many different researchers that it practically constitutes a sub-discipline at the boundary between biology and physics. Since I cannot hope to demonstrate to you the validity of these ideas, and you shouldn't trust me if I claim to do so, why am I presenting them? Because my purpose is philosophical. I wish to break down a prejudice, the conviction that a certain sort of theory couldn't possibly work. We have talked about how Hume's philosophical trajectory got deflected by his inability to take seriously an opening in the wall that he dimly saw. He thought he knew that there was no point in heading any further in that direction, and, as Socrates never tired of pointing out, thinking you know when you don't is the main cause of philosophical paralysis. If I can show that it is conceivable that the Darwinian idea can carry through all the way down, this will preempt a family of glib dismissals that is all too familiar and open our minds to other possibilities. 2. Molecular evolution. The smallest catalytically active protein molecules of the living cell consist of at least 100 amino acids. For even such a short molecule, there exist 20 to the 100th power, approximately equal to 10 to the 130th power, alternative arrangements of the 20 basic monomers. This shows that already on the lowest level of complexity, that of the biological macromolecules, an almost unlimited variety of structures is possible. Bernd Olaf Cupers, 1990, page 11. Our task is to find an algorithm, a natural law that leads to the origin of information. Manfred Eigen, 1992, page 12. In describing the power of the central claim of Darwinism in the previous section, I helped myself to a slight, exclamation point, exaggeration. I said that every living thing is the descendant of a living thing. This cannot be true, for it implies an infinity of living things, a set with no first number. Since we know that the total number of living things on Earth up till now is large but finite, we seem to be obliged, logically, to identify a first member, Adam, the protobacterium, if you like. But how could such a first member come to exist? A whole bacterium is much, much too complicated just to happen into existence by cosmic accident. The DNA of a bacterium, such as E. coli, has around 4 million nucleotides in it, almost all of them precisely in order. It is quite clear, moreover, that a bacterium could not get by with much less. So here is a quandary. Since living things have existed for only a finite time, there must have been a first one. But since all living things are complex, there couldn't have been a first one. There could only be one solution, and we know it well in outline. Before there were bacteria with autonomous metabolisms, there were much simpler quasi-living things, like viruses, but unlike them in not yet having any living things to live off parasitically. From the chemist's point of view, viruses are just huge, complex crystals, but thanks to their complexity, they don't just sit there, they do things. In particular, they reproduce or self-replicate with variations. A virus travels light, packing no metabolic machinery, so it either stumbles upon the energy and materials required for self-replication or self-repair, or eventually it succumbs to the second law of thermodynamics and falls apart. Nowadays, living cells provide concentrated storehouses for viruses, and viruses have evolved to exploit them. But in the early days, they had to scrounge for less efficient ways of making more copies of themselves. Viruses today don't all use double-stranded DNA. Some use an ancestral language composed of single-stranded RNA, which of course still plays a role in our own reproductive system as an intermediary messenger system during expression. If we follow standard practice and reserve the term virus for a parasitic macromolecule, we need a name for these earliest ancestors. Computer programmers call a cobbled-together fragment of coded instructions that performs a particular task a macro. So I propose to call these pioneers macros, to stress that although they are just huge macromolecules, they are also bits of program or algorithm, bare, minimal self-reproducing mechanisms, remarkably like the computer viruses that have recently emerged to fascinate and plague us. Ray, 1992, Dawkins, 1993. Since these pioneer macros reproduced, they met the necessary Darwinian conditions for evolution. and it is now clear that they spent the better part of 1 billion years evolving on Earth before there were any living things. Even the simplest replicating macro is far from simple, however, a composition with thousands or millions of parts, depending on how we count the raw materials that go to make it. The alphabet letters adenine, cytosine, guanine, thymine, and uracil are bases that are not too complex to arise in the normal course of prebiotic affairs. RNA, which came before DNA, has uracil, whereas DNA has thymine. Expert opinion differs, however, on whether these blocks could synthesize themselves by a series of coincidences into something as fancy as a self-replicator. The chemist Graham Cairn Smith, 1982 and 1985, presents an updated version of Paley's argument, aimed at the molecular level. The process of synthesizing DNA fragments, even by the advanced methods of modern organic chemists, is highly elaborate. This shows that their chance creation is as improbable as Paley's watch in a windstorm. Nucleotides are too expensive. Cairn Smith, 1985, pages 45 through 49. DNA exhibits too much design work to be a mere product of chance, Cairn Smith argues. But he then proceeds to deduce an ingenious, if speculative and controversial, account of how that work might have been done. Whether or not Cairn Smith's theory is eventually confirmed, it is well worth sharing simply because it so perfectly instantiates the fundamental Darwinian strategy. A good Darwinian, faced yet again with the problem of finding a needle in a haystack of design space, would cast about for a still simpler form of replicator that could somehow serve as a temporary scaffolding to hold the protein parts or nucleotide bases in place until the whole protein or macro could get assembled. Wondrous to say, there is a candidate with just the right properties. And more wondrous still, it is just what the Bible ordered. Clay. Cairn Smith shows that in addition to the carbon-based self-replicating crystals of DNA and RNA, there are also much simpler, he calls them low-tech, silicon-based self-replicating crystals. And these silicates, as they are called, could themselves be the product of an evolutionary process. They form the ultra-fine particles of clay, of the sort that builds up just outside the strong currents and turbulent eddies in streams, and the individual crystals differ subtly at the level of molecular structure in ways that they pass on when they seed the processes of crystallization that achieve their self-replication. Cairn Smith develops intricate arguments to show how fragments of protein and RNA, which would be naturally attracted to the surfaces of these crystals like so many fleas, could eventually come to be used by the silicate crystals as tools in furthering their own replication processes. According to this hypothesis, which, like all really fertile ideas, has many neighboring variations, any one of which might prove to be the eventual winner, the building blocks of life began their careers as quasi-parasites of sorts, clinging to replicating clay particles and growing in complexity in the furtherance of the needs of the clay particles until they reached a point where they could fend for themselves. No skyhook, just a ladder that could be thrown away, as Wittgenstein once said in another context, once it had been climbed. But this cannot be close to the whole story, even if it is all true. Suppose that short, self-replicating strings of RNA got created by this low-tech process. Cairn Smith calls these entirely self-involved replicators naked genes, because they aren't for anything except their own replication, which they do without outside help. We are still left with a major problem. How did these naked genes ever come to be clothed? How did these solipsistic self-reproducers ever come to specify particular proteins, the tiny enzyme machines that build the huge bodies that carry today's genes from generation to generation? But the problem is worse than that. For these proteins don't just build bodies. They are needed to assist in the very process of self-replication once a string of RNA or DNA gets long. Although short strings of RNA can replicate themselves without enzyme assistance, longer strings need a retinue of helpers, and specifying them requires a very long sequence, longer than could be replicated with high enough fidelity until those very enzymes were already present. We seem to face paradox once again, in a vicious circle succinctly described by John Maynard Smith. One cannot have accurate replication without a length of RNA of, say, 2,000 base pairs. And one cannot have that much RNA without accurate replication. Maynard Smith, 1979, page 445. One of the leading researchers on this period of evolutionary history is Manfred Eigen. In his elegant little book, Steps Towards Life, 1992, a good place to continue your exploration of these ideas, he shows how the macros gradually built up what he calls the molecular toolkit that living cells use to recreate themselves, while also building around themselves the sorts of structures that became, in due course, the protective membranes of the first prokaryotic cells. This long period of pre-cellular evolution has left no fossil traces, but it has left plenty of clues of its history in the texts that have been transmitted to us through its descendants, including, of course, the viruses that swarm around us today. By studying the actual surviving texts, the specific sequences of A, C, G, and T in the DNA of higher organisms, and the A, C, G, and U of their RNA counterparts, researchers can deduce a great deal about the actual identity of the earliest self-replicating texts using refined versions of the same techniques the philologists used to reconstruct the words that Plato actually wrote. Some sequences in our own DNA are truly ancient, even traceable, via translation back into the earlier RNA language, to sequences that were composed in the earliest days of macroevolution. Let's go back to the time when the nucleotide bases, A, C, G, T, and U, were occasionally present here and there in varying amounts, possibly congregated around some of Cairns-Smith's clay crystals. The 20 different amino acids, the building blocks for all proteins, also occur with some frequency under a wide range of non-biotic conditions. So we can help ourselves to them as well. Moreover, it has been shown by Sidney Fox, Fox and Dose, 1972, that individual amino acids can condense into proteinoids, protein-like substances that have a very modest catalytic ability. Eigen, 1992, page 32. This is but a small but important step up, since catalytic ability, the capacity to facilitate a chemical reaction, is the fundamental talent of any protein. Now suppose some of the bases come to pair up, C with G and A with U, and make smallish, complementary sequences of RNA, less than 100 pairs long, that can replicate crudely without enzymatic helpers. In terms of the Library of Babel, we would now have a printing press and a bookbindery, but the books would be too short to be good for anything except making more of themselves, with lots of misprints. And they would not be about anything. We may seem to be right back where we started, or even worse. When we bottom out at the level of molecular building blocks, we face a design problem that is more like construction out of tinker toy than gradual sculpting and modeling clay. Under the rigid rules of physics, either the atoms jump together into stable patterns, or they don't. Fortunately for us, indeed, fortunately for all living things, scattered in the vast space of possible proteins, there happen to be protein constructions that, if found, permit life to go forward. How might they get found? Somehow, We have to get those proteins together with the protein hunters, the fragments of self-replicating nucleotide strings that will eventually come to specify them in the macros they compose. Eigen shows how the vicious circle can turn friendly if it is expanded into a hypercycle with more than two elements. Eigen and Schuster, 1977. This is a difficult technical concept, but the underlying idea is clear enough. Imagine a circumstance in which fragments of type A can enhance the prospects of hunks of B, which in turn promote the well-being of bits of C, which, completing the loop, permit the replication of more fragments of A, and so forth, in a mutually reinforcing community of elements, until the point is reached where the whole process can take off, creating environments that normally serve to replicate longer and longer strings of genetic material. Maynard Smith, 1979, is a great help in understanding the idea of a hypercycle. See also Eigen, 1983. But even if this is possible in principle, how could it get started? If all possible proteins and all possible nucleotide texts were truly equiprobable, then it would be hard to see how the process could ever get going. Somehow the bland, mixed-up confetti of ingredients has to get some structure imposed on it, concentrating a few likely-to-succeed candidates and thereby making them still more likely to succeed. Remember the coin-tossing tournament in Chapter 2? Somebody has to win. But the winner wins in virtue of no virtue, but simply in virtue of historical accident. The winner is not bigger or stronger or better than the other contestants, but is still the winner. It now seems that something similar happens in prebiotic molecular evolution, with a Darwinian twist. Winners get to make extra copies of themselves for the next round, so that, without any selection for cause, as they say when dismissing potential jurors, dynasties of sheer replicative prowess begin to emerge. If we start with a purely random assortment of contestants drawn from the pool of self-replicating fragments, even if they are not initially distinguishable in terms of their replicative prowess, those that happen to win in the early rounds will occupy more of the slots in the subsequent rounds, flooding the space with trails of highly similar, short texts, but still leaving vast hyper-volumes of the space utterly empty and inaccessible for good. The initial threads of proto-life can emerge before there is any difference in skill, becoming the actuality from which the tree of life can then grow, thanks to tournaments of skill. As Eigen's colleague Bernd Olaf Cooper's, 1990, page 150, puts it, "The theory predicts that biological structures exist, but not what biological structures exist." This is enough to build plenty of bias into the probability space from the outset. So some of the possible macros, inevitably, are more probable, more likely to be stumbled upon in the vast space of possibilities than others. Which ones? The fitter ones? Not in any non-trivial sense, but just in the tautological sense of being identical to, or nearly identical to, previous winners, who in turn tended to be almost identical to still earlier winners. In the million-dimension library of Mendel, sequences that differ at a single locus are shelved next to each other in some dimension. The distance of any one volume from another is technically known as the Hamming distance. This process spreads winners out gradually, taking leaps of small Hamming distances from any initial starting point in any and all directions in the library. This is the most rudimentary possible case of the rich get richer. And since the success of the string has an explanation with no reference beyond the string itself, and its resemblance as a string to its parent string, this is a purely syntactic definition of fitness, as opposed to a semantic definition of fitness. Cooper's, 1990, page 141. That is, You don't have to consider what the string means in order to determine its fitness. We heard in Chapter 6 that mere typographical change could never explain the design that needs explaining, any more than you could explain the difference in quality between two books by comparing their relative frequencies of alphabetical characters. But before we can have the meaningful, self-replicating codes that make this possible, we have to have self-replicating codes that don't mean a thing. Their only function is to replicate themselves. As Eigen, 1992, page 15, puts it, "The structural stability of the molecule has no bearing upon the semantic information which it carries, and which is not expressed until the product of translation appears. This is the birth of the ultimate QWERTY phenomenon. But, like the cultural case that gives it its name, it was not entirely without point, even from the outset. Perfect equiprobability could have dissolved into a monopoly by a purely random process, as we have just talked about. But perfect equiprobability is hard to come by in nature at any point. And at the very beginnings of this process of text generation, a bias was present. Of the four bases, A, C, G, and T, G and C are the most structurally stable. Calculation of the necessary binding energies, along with experiments on binding and synthesis, show that sequences rich in G and C are best at self-replication by template instruction without the help of enzymes." Eigen, 1992, page 34. This is, you might say, a natural or physical spelling bias. In English, E and T appear more frequently than, say, U or J. But not because E's and T's are harder to erase, or easier to photocopy, or to write. In fact, of course, the explanation runs the other way around. We tend to use the easiest to read and write symbols for the most frequently used letters. In Morse code, for example, E is assigned a single dot, and T a single dash. In RNA and DNA, this explanation is reversed. C and G are favored because they are the most stable in replication, not because they occur most frequently in genetic words. This spelling bias is just syntactic at the outset, but it unites with a semantic bias. Examination of the genetic code by the philological methods indicates that its first codons were rich in G and C. The sequences